first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to present in this forum. It's greatly appreciated. When we think of cerebrospinal fluid and hydrocephalus, at first glance, it all seems so deceptively simple. The classic view is that cerebrospinal fluid is formed within the ventricular system by the choroid plexus. It convects through various aqueducts into the subarachnoid compartment, around the spinal cord, or over the convexities, and it is ultimately absorbed through arachnoid projections into the cranial veins, most notably the superior sagittal sinus, but some other ones as well. And in terms of hydrocephalus, it's fairly well established that if one of these aqueducts gets blocked, it can balloon out the ventricle. And it's also believed, without really much evidence, if there's an obstruction of the, at the level of the arachnoid villus, that the hydrocephalus will also occur. So this is the classical view. The realities are somewhat different. And in terms of how the clinical features of hydrocephalus, I'll leave that up to Dr. Drake to talk about that in the next presentation. What I want to talk about is CSF absorption. Because in my view, and the view of an increasing number of investigators in this area, this whole concept is probably completely wrong. And indeed, I'll go so far as to say I think that this fixation that people have had with this classical theory of how CSF is absorbed has really done some disservice to the field, because it's distorted all of our concepts as to how hydrocephalus might develop. And even a cursory glance at the literature or some of the clinical features tells you that this concept can't possibly be correct. First of all, there's very limited quantitative support, and I'll review briefly the type of support that exists. There are developmental issues. CSF formation occurs in the fetus, and yet in the human fetus there are no arachnoid granulations or villi. They begin to develop around the time of birth and increase as the individual ages. So how is CSF absorbed under these conditions? In certain animals, there's no pressure gradient here. It is believed that the CSF pressure is greater than the pressure in the vein, and therefore drainage occurs due to this convective force. But in rats and mice, for example, there is no pressure gradient until 20 days after birth. So how does CSF get absorbed during that period? Many arachnoid projections are not associated with veins, so how do they function? People have attempted to induce hydrocephalus by blocking the intracranial veins and have largely failed. Well, if this is the site of the major absorption, this is inconsistent with the observation I just made. Pathologists have taken at autopsy children who have passed away with hydrocephalus and tried to correlate either the lack of granulation with hydrocephalus or whatever, and there's no convincing evidence to suggest that a developmental defect in these structures leads to hydrocephalus. And finally, just from a theoretical perspective, hydrocephalus generally relates to a dilation of the ventricular system. If you have a block at this level, you would imagine that the subarachnoid space would expand, not the ventricles. So even from a theoretical perspective, this concept makes very, very little sense. So I would like to turn your attention, ironically, to the lymphatic vessels, and I say ironically because there are no lymphatics in the parenchyma of the brain or spinal cord. But we and many others before have done studies such as this, where you can put a radioactive protein tracer or some kind of colored dye into the CSF compartment, and the remarkable thing is that you find it all over the body. Very rapidly. You find it in lots of lymph nodes in the head and neck region. For example, if you inject the radioactive tracer into cranial subarachnoid compartment, the cervicals and preauriculars and retropharyngeal and many other lymph nodes light up, as does the tissues in the paranasal area. If you inject the tracer into the spinal CSF compartment, the lumbar lymph nodes and intercostal nodes and so on also light up. So clearly, there is an association between cerebrospinal fluid and lymph. And luckily, you've probably had your breakfast by now, so these shots won't disturb you. But the remarkable thing is if you put a contrast agent into the subarachnoid compartment of a newborn lamb, you find a lot of it extracranially. So here's the brain, This is the cribriform plate right here. This is the olfactory bulb. And we find a vast network of lymphatic vessels that have taken up this material. And if we inject a blue microfill contrast agent into the blood vessels, we can very nicely separate the blue blood vessels from the lymphatic vessels that have taken up the CSF agent. And indeed, if we look carefully at the cribriform plate, we can actually see areas where the dye is passing through. And going a little bit more anteriorly, we find that all of the anterior ethmoid terminal system has a vast network of lymphatics that have taken up the contrast agent. This is the nasal septum, and here you see the lymphatic vessels filled with the yellow microfill, and you can see some blood vessels that are unstained. About the anatomical connections, again, here we have the cribriform plate. Here we have some of the olfactory neurons, and you can see a sleeve of the microfill along these neurons. Here we have the extensive lymphatic network, and this isn't showing up too well on the image, but this is the cribriform plate, which is cartilage in the newborn lamb. It hasn't ossified yet. This is the olfactory bulb. Here's an olfactory neuron. And I'll just point out that the microfill is removed during tissue processing largely, although we can see some remnants here in the perineural sheath. And if we go a little bit further, again, here we have the cribriform plate, two olfactory neurons, and the submucosa of the olfactory epithelium is filled with microfill containing lymphatic vessels. And I'll just quickly show you how they're connected. Here we have lymphatic vessels with residual microfill. Here we have an olfactory neuron. This is the perineural sheath, and these are lymphatic vessels, and you can see that the lymphatics are separated from the perineural sheath by a single layer of endothelium. So this is clearly then one of the dominant pathways in sheep by which CSF gains access to the extracranial lymphatic compartment. Now, where does this material go? And I'm just sort of laying the anatomical background before we talk about some of the quantitative studies. Much of the microfill, or the CSF, drains above the soft palate into a basket weave network of lymphatic vessels and ultimately into a variety of lymph nodes. And here we can see the retropharyngeal lymph node at this level. And if we go a little bit further, we can capture these microfill-filled lymphatics. These are prenodal or afferent lymphatic vessels that transport the CSF to various lymph nodes, the retropharyngeals, the preauriculars, submandibulars, and multiple cervical lymph nodes in the neck. And while I'm not going to talk about it, many investigators are interested in this from the perspective of immunology, because brain antigens clearly make it into peripheral lymph nodes, and it's thought that this may stimulate immune responses and subsequent attack on nervous tissue. All right, so that's a basic anatomical background. How can we quantify the lymphatic transport? Well, there are a number of ways, but most of them involve the administration of a radioactive protein tracer, like radioactive human serum albumin, tagged with either I-125 or I-131. And this study was actually done in a fetal sheep. In fact, we only had two successful fetal sheep studies. They're very difficult to do. We cannulated cervical lymphatics, the thoracic duct, and of course we had a catheter in the bloodstream in utero. We were able to determine, after you inject the radioactive tracer into the cisterna magna of the fetal animal, that the concentration rises quite rapidly in the cervical lymph, but is very, very low in the blood and in the thoracic duct. And this is not new. Others have demonstrated this in some other species, and we've done it many times in adult sheep as well. So how can we take this kind of data and turn it into some sort of quantification? Well, our initial attempts were in collaboration with Michael Flesner. And I'm certainly not a mathematician. Michael Flesner is, and he models interstitial transport in the anterior abdominal wall as it relates to peritoneal dialysis issues. But we worked with him to design a series of mass balance equations that would permit us to do a variety of studies, and this was the first one. And what we did was a two-phase experiment. In phase one, we injected a protein tracer, like I-125 albumin, is into the CSF compartment, and we monitored its mass transport into the plasma, correcting the recovery data for tracer that was lost in the normal filtration process. And in the second phase, in the same animal, a few days later, we did some surgery, we cannulated the cervical ducts, and then diverted that lymph from the animal. We repeated the experiment with the same mass of tracer added to the CSF, but now with a different radionuclide. And we had a third tracer that allowed us to estimate this coefficient of elimination. And we were quite surprised, because we had no expectation at this point in the study that this pathway, that is, that the lymphatics would be significant in terms of transport. But what we were able to find before diverting the lymph, we have the black bars. This is the transport average between 1 and 6 hours. After diverting the lymph in the same animal, we can see that the plasma recovery is at least 50% inhibited. And we basically got the same sort of result in rats. Now, this just shows some sham experiments where the actual recovery increases slightly, although not statistically significant. So this, for the first time, gave us a number, 50% transport by lymphatics, which was astonishing to us because, of course, everyone assumed it would be zero. We then went on to do a little bit more sophisticated approach. In this case, we wanted to estimate volumetric transport rather than just mass transport of the tracer. And to do that, Michael Flesner devised this three-compartment model, CSF, lymph, and plasma, sort of basically similar to the previous, except that the problem we had is we were cannulating the lymphatic vessel, we were adding a protein tracer into the CSF, and we could, of course, collect the radioactive tracer and the volume of lymph here, but we had to contend with the fact that tracer could go via other routes, presumably arachnoid villi routes, into the plasma, and then refilter back into our lymphatic compartment. And this would tend to overestimate the recovery. So what Michael did was devise another equation using a second tracer in which we could estimate the volumetric transport of this second tracer ML per hour, from plasma back into lymph. And then this factor was multiplied by the concentration, the changing concentration of the CSF tracer in plasma was subtracted from our estimate of lymph to correct for this factor. And basically, the long and the short of it is that the data mirrored what we had already demonstrated in the mass transport studies. We found in sheep a volumetric flow rate of about 4 milliliters per hour, of which nearly half came via the lymphatics. Now, we recognized then, and in retrospect recognize now, several problems associated with this type of approach. First of all, we had some anatomical limitations in that we could only cannulate a certain number of these very tiny lymphatics and measure the flow rates over a period of time. And these studies, by the way, were done in conscious animals. They were allowed to recover after the surgery. So we figured that any of our estimates were liable to be extremely conservative and minimize the lymphatic contribution to CSF transport. Secondly, we were concerned that we didn't get good mixing of the tracer in the CSF compartment. It's not like putting a tracer into the bloodstream where you expect fairly rapid mixing. CSF compartments, compartment is very complex. There are areas where there's probably stagnation, and getting a complete mixing of the tracer was probably an unrealistic expectation. In addition to that, we made the assumption, which we now know is completely false, that because this lymph was diverted from plasma, that any transport from CSF into plasma was due to arachnoid granulations. And I'll come back to this, because clearly that is not the case. In fact, this transport appears to be lymphatic as well. The final problem with this approach is that it tends to ignore an extremely important factor, and that is intracranial pressure. And we now know that intracranial pressure is really the determining factor as to which pathways are recruited to transport cerebrospinal fluid over time. But suffice it to say, this rather amateurish first mathematical model allowed us to at least get a handle on transport processes, and for the first time alerted us to the fact that, well, maybe there was something here of merit, and indeed the lymphatics were important for cerebrospinal fluid absorption. So we continued. We wanted to find more direct evidence that this was the case, and we conducted a study where we varied intracranial pressure, and we measured the lymphatic pressure in the cervical ducts here in the lower neck. And even though there are all kinds of compliance issues and we're measuring the pressure very far downstream, we could see that as intracranial pressure went up, the cervical lymphatic pressure also went up, whereas the lymphatic pressure in other compartments, for example, the intestinal lymphatic, was unchanged. And indeed, if we look at flow rates, as you elevate intracranial pressure, lymph flow goes up, and we were actually able to estimate the proportion of lymph in the cervical ducts that had its origins as CSF. Because remember, lymphatics collect lymph from all over the body, not just from the CSF compartment. Excuse me. And we were able to determine, for example, that at an intracranial pressure of about 10 centimeters of water, about 10 to 15% of the lymph in the cervical duct had its origins as cerebrospinal fluid. As we got to pathologically high pressures, for example, 70 centimeters of water, it was closer to 80%. And indeed, if you were watching the lymphatic vessel, it became a very kind of a distended tube with clear fluid in it, essentially containing almost entirely cerebrospinal fluid. So that suggested then, or further supported, a role of lymphatics in CSF transport. But I think by far the most useful approach we developed to assess this related to the surgical interference of CSF absorption at the level of the cribriform plate. And to do this, a number of individuals in the lab were able to cut a piece of the cartilage out of the nasal area and go in and actually seal the cribriform plate on the extracranial side after scraping all the tissue away. And we used bone wax sort of a cyoacrylamate glue, a crazy glue, essentially. And we devised a series of two-phase experiments where in phase one we could measure some transport parameter. In phase two, in the same animal, we were able to seal the cribriform plate and repeat the same perturbation and see the impact and measure the impact. And I'll just go over a couple of the results. First of all, we wanted to see what effect this would have on intracranial pressure. And if we negate the spinal subarachnoid compartment, which is a different issue entirely, and I'll come back to that in a moment. So basically, we tied off the thecal sac, so there's no entry of CSF into the spinal cord. But all we're doing now is sealing the cribriform plate. Initially, there's a drop in CSF pressure because CSF leaks out during the scraping procedure. But then over time, CSF pressure goes up, and indeed, on average, the mean systolic and diastolic pressures are doubled. The sham surgery had no effect. So here we were actually perturbing the system extracranially and having quite a dramatic effect on an intracranial measure, in this case, the CSF pressure. But in addition to this, we could do other things. We could do some infusion studies where we generated steady-state pressures, steady-state flows, and we could transform the data and plot intracranial pressure versus CSF absorption both before and after sealing the cribriform plate. Again, the spinal cord has been negated. So these are essentially conductance curves, the slope of which relates to the resistance of the absorption mechanism. And what you find is that when you seal the cribriform plate, you shift this curve quite markedly to the left. And this is important for a number of reasons. First of all, For a given intracranial pressure, the flow rate is considerably less after sealing the plate than it was in the native state. And the corollary of that is also true. For example, at a flow rate of 0.1 ml per minute, the initial intact system required an intracranial pressure about 8, 9 centimeters of water. After sealing the cribriform plate extracranially to generate the same CSF absorption requires a pressure more akin to about 20 centimeters of water or double. So clearly this procedure has a marked effect on CSF transport. But even more interesting to us is we could take that data and recalculate the proportion of transport that occurred through cribriform and non-cribriform pathways. And in this particular case, we were able to see by extrapolating here to close to the opening pressure that the vast majority of CSF transport, again, cranial transport, not including the spinal cord, was through the cribriform plate. And only a small portion at low pressures was non-cribriform plate related. The other important factor here is that as we elevate the pressure, this non-cribriform contribution is increasing. And we predict that perhaps at about 30 to 40 centimeters of water, these two curves would meet. So here we can see then that our tracer studies, the mathematical or our amateurish model, actually underestimated CSF transport into lymphatics by a considerable amount. Because here again, we're manipulating the system extracranially and we're able to reduce transport by over 80% by simply sealing the cribriform plate. So that data that I just showed was in newborn lambs that have very, very few arachnoid granulations or villi. This data was derived in a similar fashion in adult sheep, and basically the same parameters apply. This is the conductance curve before sealing the plate. This is the conductance curve after sealing the plate. And again, we could make the case, if we rework the data, that the majority of transport at low pressures is through a cribriform pathway, and only when you elevate pressure are non-cribriform routes recruited. Now, I focused predominantly on the cribriform pathway, but there are other areas by which, or other locations by which lymphatics can gain access to cerebrospinal fluid. And one of the things we found with the microfill is that every cranial nerve, every spinal nerve, contain microfill in these longitudinal channels. You can see some others up here. And whether this was in a spinal nerve coming off the thorax or whether it was in the neck region, it didn't matter. All nerves had this pattern. And when we looked at the histology, we found that the microfill was located within the nerve fascicles itself or in the subperineurium. This is what the vagus nerve looks like without microfill. This is what it looks like with microfill, and indeed we can get the same kind of images without microfill by just elevating intracranial pressure. And we're now conducting a study where we quantify the amount of space taken up, free space, by fluid in these fascicles as a function of intracranial pressure. And it looks like there's a linear relationship. Importantly, from the perspective of lymphatics, is that at numerous locations we find lymphatics emerging from the epineurium or the mesoneurium, whatever. And here's one that's emerging from the zygomatic nerve. We see it quite frequently in the trigeminal and other nerves as well. So clearly, then, the endoneurial spaces provide a link between the CSF compartment and all of the lymphatic vessels and a vast number of lymph nodes around the body. And we haven't even begun to contemplate the role of this pathway in terms of volumetric transport. It's probably higher resistance, and we can actually determine that now. We have the means to measure intrafascicular pressure. So we're hoping in the next 6 to 8 months to actually determine an opening pressure for these endoneurial transport routes. Now, this is just the same thing. This is the spinal cord in the thorax. Here's the vertebrae. Here's the subdural microfill. And every one of these nerves emanating off the spinal cord contains microfill. And this is, I think, the explanation as to why lymph nodes all over the body light up with the radioactive tracer, because it's transporting along these endoneural pathways and gaining access to lymphatics all over the body. Okay, just to remind me to say that we've quantified cranial and spinal transport, and in both, this is adult sheep, but the same is true in neonatal animals. About 75% of transport at resting pressure is cranial, and about 25% is spinal. And you can see from the slope of this line that the resistance is greater in the spinal route, but nonetheless, we think that it's quite important under some circumstances. All right, now, just briefly, what about the classical concept? What about these strange things called arachnoid villi and granulations? On the right, we've reproduced from the study of Mann et al. Really the classic quantitative approach that people have used to justify transport via the arachnoid granulations. And this is the diagram that's in the textbooks, Hugh Davison's Bible on CSF physiology that I'm sure all the medical students use or neurosurgeons use. Basically, what he found was that if you pressurize the system with bolus infusion with some sort of tracer in the CSF, that the concentration of this tracer was greater in the sagittal sinus than it was in peripheral blood. And he used this as argument that this transport route was functional. The problem with his data and the data of others is the fact that the pressure, the peak pressures he was generating, were around 80 centimeters of water, which is clearly pathological. I mean, in humans, I think anything above 20, 25 would be considered pathological. So in order to get quantitative evidence for enrichment of tracer in cranial blood versus peripheral blood, he had to use very, very high pressure. So we essentially wanted to repeat this experiment in both neonatal and adult sheep. And this just illustrates that our adult sheep have numerous arachnoid granulations. Here they are stained with Evans blue, and here with the microfill. This is what one looks like histologically. In our neonates, about half of them have scattered granulations and about half have no obvious granulations, although there may be arachnoid villi present. So what we did then was repeat the Mann approach, and basically we expressed the concentration of the tracer in the superior sagittal sinus, or measured from the torcula, as a ratio. That is, we divided the CPM per ml of this blood by the CPM per ml in the periphery. And we devised a system to pressurize the intracranial system such that we could generate gradients of pressure between the superior sagittal sinus and the CSF. And for example, if we double the normal pressure gradient, which is about 5 centimeters of water, we find virtually no enrichment of tracer. So this would argue against transport into the cranial venous system. If, however, we really up the pressure such that we get 4 or 6 times higher than normal gradient between the CSF compartment and the superior sagittal sinus, indeed, we can get enrichment of tracer. So this suggests then that there is some element of truth to the concept of the arachnoid projections, but there's a problem with this approach. Well, there are many problems, but one of them is that because we get a ratio of 1 doesn't necessarily mean there's no transport by the arachnoid granulation, because we could argue that the lymphatics simply ramp up their contribution, and basically, since we express this as a ratio, if this keeps pace with transport via the projections, the ratio might remain 1, and yet we could argue there's still a tremendous amount of transport at this level. So we went back to the drawing board, and we repeated these experiments, this time in adult sheep, and we blocked all of the lymphatic pathways that we could. So basically, we sealed the cribriform plate on the extracranial side, we ligated the fecal sac of the spinal cord, and now, presumably, we've created the ideal conditions favorable for arachnoid projections to give the tracer into the CSF compartment. And if we have a gradient of 20 centimeters of water, which is about 5 times the normal gradient, you can see, again, there's very little enrichment of tracer. I should point out that the black circles represent the fully intact preparation. So this argues, then, against the idea that there was a lot of transport via the granulations, but that the lymphatics were compensating, because if we get rid of, let's say, 80% of the lymphatic transport, we still essentially don't get any significant enrichment in the cranial venous system. It isn't until we are able to pressurize the system such that we get gradients absolutely huge and pathological that we can get very good evidence for transport via this pathway. So what we're now beginning to think is that while transport can occur directly into the venous system, presumably through the granulations, but we don't know that for sure, but these structures seem to act as a high pressure relief valve. Perhaps an analogy would be the turbocharger wastegate in a racing car or in some sports car that tends to vent off pressure when it gets, or vent off CSF when the pressure gets abnormally high. Now, just a final bit of evidence, we've also conducted a series of studies in the fetus, the sheep fetus, the neonatal lamb, sort of 3 to 7 day old lambs, and in adult animals, or perhaps teenagers, they're about 30 to 40 kilograms. And the remarkable thing is that despite the fact that we have this wide variety of the presence or absence of arachnoid projections, the remarkable thing is that looking at CSF conductance, which is essentially the same in our system as CSF absorption, or outflow resistance, they're identical at each stage of development. The one constant is that we have strong experimental support for lymphatics. So while not definitive by itself, the data suggests or supports the notion that really CSF transport is predominantly a lymphatic phenomenon, and that the arachnoid projections really are secondary. And that's what I've tried to diagram here. Now, we're running out of time. I don't have the time to go into all of the implications, but I'll just name a few of them. First of all, it's hard to imagine why hydrocephalus ever develops, because there's so many CSF absorption sites, and they're scattered all over the body. In addition, we can see that a great many of the forces that would regulate this transport are extracranial, not intracranial. And I'll give you one example. You notice that I've always drawn the lymphatics as beaded structures, and that's because the lymphatics are really a series of hearts called lymphangions. And these lymphangions have been modeled by us and by others much along the same lines as Sagawa modeled the function of the heart. Looking at the pressure-volume relationships, we can define a systolic phase, a diastolic phase, and we know that these individual lymph pumps respond to a whole host of pharmacologic agents, inflammatory mediators, and whatnot, to the extent that CSF factors, soluble factors, may be entering lymph and affecting the pumping activity of these lymphatic vessels. And the pumping activity is remarkable. In humans, Waldemar Olszewski put a plastic catheter in military volunteers in the popliteal prenodal vessel and measured stop flow pressures around 100 millimeters of mercury. And these pressures were generated through the contractions of these very tiny lymphatic vessels. So this lymph pump has potential to regulate CSF dynamics again, primarily by modulating the pumping extracranially. And there are other issues. For example, we're about to measure the pressure in these initial lymphatics so that with a micropipette servo null system so that we can define the true opening pressure for the system. We're also considering the role of lymph nodes because the concentration of protein in the blood is greater than in the lymph, about double. Because there's a plasma oncotic gradient, water is resorbed into the bloodstream here. So the lymph node may also act as a pressure valve to vent CSF. So it's another concept that we're quite interested in pursuing. So finally, where do we go from here? Well, obviously our studies are in animals, and we're now working on a deal with the University of Toronto Medical School for access to some cadaveric material so that we can use our microfill contrast agent to look at similar pathways in humans. I won't review the evidence because we don't have time, but there's all kinds of circumstantial evidence that humans are responding in exactly the same way as animals. But we can start to think of hydrocephalus in different terms. For example, we can test if certain perturbations that induce, for example, communicating hydrocephalus, say an intracranial bleed, if that actually obstructs flow into these initial lymphatics in the perinasal region. We have the means to actually obstruct the cribriform plate and measure the pressures in the ventricle and over the subarachnoid space. By blocking lymphatic transport, can one generate a transmantle pressure gradient that is consistent with ventricular dilation? This is actually a very controversial area because, at least with communicating hydrocephalus, many people have been unable to induce it, this pressure gradient in conventional means. So I think the important point is that we can kind of rephrase a lot of concepts and hypotheses unfettered by this obsession with arachnoid projections that clearly have a function that is different from the one that is the conventional view. And I'll just point out the fact that there are many people contributing to this project, and I'll just name specifically Michael Flesner, who is deserving of the title of a mathematician and who did some of these mass balance equations for us. Thank you very much.